The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. I hope all of you are doing well. This is another very important conference in the framework of our founder celebration. As you know, we were created by two courageous women in 1896. Elizabeth Spencer Massey and Emma Gillet, in a moment where women could not enter into a legal profession. It's interesting, they could not enter into a legal profession because by nature they were unsuitable for the practice of law. That creates very serious philosophical and practical problems. Every time we blame nature for something, we need to be very careful. Our founding mothers set into motion this process, very important that law was a powerful instrument to achieve equality. And they really wanted to take law seriously and to bring to practice the formal values that were in the expressed in the legal system. And they thought that educating lawyers, women and men alike, with important values was essential to achieve the type of world where they wanted to live. Well, in the framework of that, we have over 60 conferences in the spring to address the issues of our time. And this is a very important one, because we have one of the top legal thinkers in this country, and more importantly, and as importantly, a person with tremendous value and ethics that is a role model for us. I'm going to ask my colleague, Professor Linda Dodd, to introduce our visitor. And I want to thank also Professor Dodd, because she's the one who conceptualized, implemented, and organized this program. So again, I want to welcome our visitor. I want to be introduced by Professor Dodd, and I want to thank Professor Dodd for this founders program. And thank you, all of you, for your presence.
Really fitting for our founder celebration to have a founder of a new law school discussing an important legal issue, civil rights litigation in the Roberts Court era. The new dean of the University of California, Irvine, Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, is one of the nation's most respected legal scholars, one of the nation's most beloved legal teachers. He's won awards at every single institution that he's taught at. Most recently at Duke Law School, and before that at the University of Southern California. I also think that his reputation nationwide is as one of the most generous legal professionals and academics. In my experience, he accepts invitations weekly from judges' organizations, groups of legal practitioners, bar associations, as well as speaking in law schools. Just this week, Brian Leiter, who compiled lists of all sorts of interest to legal academics, recently compiled the list of most cited individual law professors. Erwin Chemerinsky was the number one most cited law professor in the country, regardless of topic, thanks to Kat Dunstein's appointment in the Obama administration. And his new law school, which is in its infancy, was listed as number 10 according to the calculations for Brian Leiter's blog. So that's a profound accomplishment. It says a lot about the kinds of professors that Dean Chemerinsky is able to attract to the new law school. My students refer to Dean Chemerinsky in the most reverential terms. I've heard the god of con law from those students clutching his horn book and con law. I know a lot of WCL students use the case book that he introduced a few years ago for constitutional law. When I was a law school, I was the one clutching the federal jurisdiction horn book, and I still consult that regularly in my own work. So I'm delighted to have Dean Chemerinsky talk about what I consider to be one of the most important areas of constitutional law, something that in first year classes we don't often talk enough about, which is how exactly we go about enforcing these rights that we're studying in these different doctrinal areas. So I look forward to your talk, and I thank you again for joining us. So please help me welcome Dean Chemerinsky.
incredibly kind introduction. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to be with you. One of the gadgets is possible. I have to tell you, when I landed last night, it was 26 degrees. I left Southern California as if it was 75 in the sun. And I'm living again, the three best reasons for living in Southern California are December, January, February. I've been asked, as you know, to talk about the Roberts Court, sort of an area of civil rights litigation. I thought what I would do is talk for about 45 minutes and leave the rest of our time for any questions that you have. Let me do this by making several observations about the Roberts Court. We're now nearing the end of the fourth term of the so-called John Roberts Court. Let me begin first by telling you a little bit about the court by the numbers. I find statistics about the Supreme Court often to be very revealing. Last year, the Supreme Court decided 67 cases after briefing the oral arguments. The year before that, the Supreme Court decided 68 cases. What makes this significant is through much of the 20th century, the Supreme Court was deciding over 200 cases a year. As recently as the 1980s, the Supreme Court averaged over 150 decisions. Now it's down to 67. That has enormously important implications for civil rights litigation and for all areas of law. More major legal questions go longer time before being resolved. More conflicts among the circuits and the states go longer time before being settled. There's another less noted implication of the smaller battle. As the number of cases has decreased, the length of the opinions has increased. I can show you a perfect inverse correlation. The term goes down. The average length of opinion, that's the words per opinion, pages per opinion, goes up. Now I'm not sure what's cause and what's effect. Does the court taking fewer cases because it wants to write longer opinions?
As I would guess, is the court writing longer opinions because it has fewer cases?
Last year, there were a number of decisions where the split of opinions were over 150 pages long. One of the things that I have to do every July is create an annual supplement to my constitutional law. There is no way to add a 150-page opinion down the side of the law students in one night without making an effort. So I have a new campaign that I hope you'll join me in. More than page with the some other interesting numbers about the court. The two justices were most frequently in agreement last term were Chief Justice John Roberts and Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. They voted together 88% of the time. The two justices next most often in agreement were Justices David Souter and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The two justices next most often in agreement were Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito. The justice most often in the majority last term, John Roberts. He dissented only six times in the court. Second observation about the court is that what matters most is the Anthony Kennedy vote. I know our tradition and deference to think we refer to as the Roberts Court. But especially from the perspective of the lawyers who are judges to the court, who stand before the justices, it is the Anthony Kennedy Court. Year before last, there were 68 decisions. 24 were decided by 5 in margin. That's significant in itself. 2 years ago, over a third of the docket was resolved by a 5-4 margin.
In those 24 5-4 cases, Anthony Kennedy was the majority in every single one of them.
I can't identify any other year with a significant number of 5-4 cases where one justice majority literally every time. Last term, there were 67 cases. 14 were decided by 5-4 or 5-4 margin. The Kennedy was the majority more than any other justice. 9 times. Not every time, but still more than any other justice. But there's an easy explanation for this.
John Roberts and Samuel Alito have been everything that conservatives could have hoped for and liberals could have feared. They're every bit as conservative as Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, and the court is ideologically divided, almost always voted together. On the other side, Justices
see that the suitor is going right, again, more often than not, and reports ideological divided together. That leaves Justice Kennedy as the swing justice.
But said, nothing else is going to be forward.
I wrote a brief last term in the Second Amendment case, District of Columbia v. Sullivan. My brief was a shameless attempt to pander to Justice Kennedy.
The real culprit was found, and the man was released in custody.
The sued the prosecutor in Section 1983 for money damages. The Supreme Court said prosecutors have absolute immunity for their prosecutorial acts, but don't they qualified immunity for their investigative or administrative acts. Courts have struggled in the 30 years since that year. Well, what's prosecutorial? They're talking about absolute immunity. Meaning no such money damages at all, until it was investigative or administrative. Last month, the Supreme Court handed down a major case expanding the scope of absolute prosecutorial immunity. This was Vandekamp versus Goldfield. Follows a man in Los Angeles by the name of Tommy Lee Goldfield. He was suspected of murders in Long Beach, California. He was detained for a crime in jail. He was convicted of those murders. Turns out he's completely innocent. 24 years in prison for murders he didn't commit. What's the evidence against the conviction? Well, there were no eyewitnesses. There was no physical evidence looking at the crime. There was no confession. Instead, what the prosecutor had to trial was two witnesses who said that they had heard Goldfield committing the murders. One of these witnesses later recanted. The other was a witness who was in the same jail cell as Goldfield, who said that he heard Goldfield at the time. This witness, ironically, had the name Dick. We got along with it, I was making the informant's name Dick. It turns out that Mr. Dick had a long history of making deals with the kind of district attorney's office. Well, he would get a reduction in charges for sentence. These games were implicating someone else. Goldstein's lawyer in trial made repeated requests to the assistant district attorney as to whether or not they could make any deal, or any deal in this case, or any benefit in exchange for testimony. And the assistant district attorney said no. Well, turns out that was untrue. They had deal. But these assistant district attorneys weren't lying. They didn't know that Dick had made deals. Okay, there were other assistant attorneys in the office. So Goldstein got exonerated and released. He brought a lawsuit against the district attorney of Los Angeles County. Then he had a job meeting him, his top deputy, his name had a clip boxing. And he failed to implement procedures to make sure that this kind of exculpatory information could work. There's no doubt that under Brady versus Maryland and subsequent cases, the prosecutor did a duty to turn this over. This is key impeachment evidence with regard to prosecutorial witness. The DA's office violated the Constitution, as well as the Code of Ethics, by mentioning the evidence. And so Goldstein's theory was that here, the failure was administrative. The district didn't create the procedures between the evidence. 9-0, the Supreme Court ruled against Goldstein. Justice Breyer wrote the opinion for the court, saying that ultimately this ties to prosecutorial decisions, choices that were made in court, and therefore it's covered by the scope of absolute prosecutorial immunity. So notice the expansion of prosecutorial immunity, and also the effect of this bill that Goldstein feels no one would be able to sue. There's a disturbing trend in the lower courts with regard to absolute immunity. Now, what are the Supreme Court going to do about it? And that's expanding the scope of who can claim absolute immunity in these areas. Remember I said, for instance, that judges have absolute immunity for the judicial acts. Well, there's a whole series now of lower court decisions giving to administrative officials absolute judicial immunity. A lot of cases involve how licensing boards, the doctors, the lawyers, the nurses, are protected by absolute judicial immunity. There's a case coming out of the Seventh Circuit a couple of years ago called Killinger versus Johnson, where a mayor suspended a restaurant's liquor license. He was suspended from selling liquor to those who are underage. He got sued by the restaurant for taking away property without due process. The Seventh Circuit ruled that the mayor was protected by absolute judicial immunity because he was functioning in a judicial capacity. There are now cases finding that members of local zoning boards are protected by absolute judicial immunity. In other words, government officials that we never think of as judges are being completely immunized to be sued by deeming the performance of a judiciary function.
Same thing is going on
with regard to prosecutors, where lower courts are expanding the scope of what's prosecutorial.
I think Dan Campbell's gold seems to be the Supreme Court for him.
Let me talk about a second certain case a couple years ago. It's a case called Root versus Liston. Root versus Liston involves a prosecutor who walked into the jail one day and asked this to a particular inmate, what does gallons say? And said $15,000. The prosecutor said, that's not enough. Raise the bail to $150,000. Questionable that the prosecutor has the authority to unilaterally increase the bail. And so when the person ultimately gets released, he sues the prosecutor and says, the prosecutor was exceeding his authority. The prosecutor violated my rights by keeping me locked up. Ordering a bail much greater than the judge said. And the Second Circuit said, no prosecutorial immunity is there. The prosecutor was functioning essentially as a judge, so we're going to give the prosecutor absolute judicial immunity. Tremendous expansion.
Well, I said for all who are sued for money damages for constitutional violations have either absolute or qualified immunity. Absolute immunity is the exception. Qualified immunity is the norm. So as lawyers, any time you want to sue a local, a state, executive, or a federal official for money damages, for any constitutional violation, you've got to overcome qualified immunity to a general absolute. And the test for qualified immunity, as I said to you earlier,
is announced in Harlow versus Fitzgerald in 1982. Government officials have qualified immunity unless they violate clearly established law
that a reasonable officer should know.
The Supreme Court, just last month, on January 21st, significantly expanded the ability of courts to dismiss cases based on qualified immunity. Look at the background.
In a series of cases in the late 1990s and the early part of this decade, the Supreme Court said whenever a government official invokes qualified immunity as a defense of a suit, the court should engage in a two-step view. First, the court should decide, taking the facts, the light that's favorable to it, is there a constitutional violation?
If so, second, then is there a clearly established law to reason the law? No. There's a good benefit of proceeding this way. Because if the court dismisses just based on qualified immunity, then there's no occasion for the development of constitutional law.
Officers can constantly get away with violating the law without there ever being any basis for money judgments because there's never been a case that says it's a constitutional law. And so in a case called Saucier versus Katz, in the early part of this decade, the Supreme Court prescribed this two-step approach.
In Pearson versus Callahan, on January 21st of this year, the Supreme Court 9-0 overruled Saucier versus Katz.
It's remarkable that the decision was not very old. It's so quickly overruled that overruled unanimously.
Now, Pearson versus Callahan involved a drug dealer who was entered into a drug transaction with an undercover police officer. He invited the police officer,
not knowing he was a police officer, of course, to come to his home.
As the undercover officer came in, a bunch of other officers then followed. The issue was under the Fourth Amendment. If a person consents for one police officer to enter the home, albeit not knowing it's a police officer, is that then consent for the entire force to come about?
There's many officers in the city consent.
And the person sued for money damages. Second, 1983 suit for violation of the Fourth Amendment. Now, under the traditional approach, there should be two questions. One, is there a constitutional violation? Second, if so, does it violate clearly established laws of the reasonable law? No. The Supreme Court an opinion by Justice Alito said, if it's clear that there's qualified immunity, then no need to decide whether there's a constitutional violation. I can point to countless cases where courts found constitutional rights, but then found qualified immunity. But at least those rights were then present for future plaintiffs to rely on. Those rights were there to limit the government officer's immunity. No longer are they there. Pearson versus Cal has been much easier for courts to dismiss. Is that qualified immunity? I want to talk about one other development with regard to 1983 outside of the immunity area. And that's the tremendous restriction on the ability of 1983 to be used to enforce other federal statutes. We haven't studied this area in the federal court class or perhaps in civil rights class. You haven't recognized that there are literally hundreds of federal laws that don't expressly authorize civil suits for money gains. Sometimes these are government benefit programs. Say Medicaid. State federal Medicaid laws. There's all sorts of requirements they have to follow. But the law doesn't authorize a civil suit for money gains. Sometimes we're talking about criminal statutes. Sometimes it's regulatory statutes. Impose duties on the state local government, but don't specifically authorize suits on the money damages. In 1980, in a case called Maine versus Thibodeau, the Supreme Court said that the statute in 1983 was used to enforce the state statutes. 1983 says it's a cause of action. Whenever somebody acting on public state law violates the Constitution and laws of the United States, Justice Brennan writing to the court says, laws means laws. All federal statutes are laws. Well, ever since the Supreme Court significantly cut back on the ability to sue under Section 93 to enforce federal statutes, for example, the Supreme Court said, well, you know, all of these 1983 to enforce federal statutes that create enforceable rights. And then the court went about narrowing the enforceable rights. Most recent case is Lustman. It was a case called Zaga versus Duck. And it involves a statute the Federal Educational Records Privacy Act. This law, FERPA, is what keeps this law school, your undergraduate institutions, from being able to release your educational records, except under neural services. This case involves whether or not Section 1983 could be used to enforce the law. It involved Gonzaga University in Washington that released information about an individual that was clearly that violated FERPA. Now, it's interesting here, 1983 applies only to those acting under color of state law. That would be local governments or state or local officials. Gonzaga University should be able to sue under Section 1983. He should dismiss on that basis. But the Supreme Court footnote that it wasn't going to deal with that issue. Clearly, five justices in the majority wanted to reach the question of can 1983 be used to enforce FERPA. The Chief Justice was writing to the court that FERPA should not be seen as a statute that creates enforceable rights. How can you imagine the Federal Educational Records and Privacy Act, which is all about privacy rights of students, isn't a statute that creates enforceable rights? The other exception that the Supreme Court has created is to say, that if Congress has indicated a desire of another statute to preclude Section 1983, then you can't use 1983 for enforcement. In theory, this makes sense. If there's another statute that provides a remedy, and that remedy was necessary to plant 1983, you don't need to have 1983. In the 1980s, in a case called Wright versus City of Roanoke, the Supreme Court said, we'll assume that every federal statute can be enforced by 1983. That it wasn't going to replace 1983 unless Congress expressly says otherwise. But about 4 years ago in the California case, the Supreme Court, came by Justice Alito, changed it. The Supreme Court said, unless Congress clearly expresses the intent that 1983 can be used to enforce a statute, then it can. Can't a non-lawyer really test? No newspaper is going to write a headline story about the ability to use 1983 to enforce federal statutes.
Well, we talk about whether or not children
get preventative medical care. When the children get permanency planning for their adoptions, whether or not Medicaid benefits will be available now is all about to use 1983 to enforce these statutes. Because otherwise, there's no enforcement practice that applies to individuals. So I was asking about 1983 and what's going on there. Let me talk about the other aspect of civil rights litigation that I was asked to address, and that's businesses. Now, I find that non-lawyers are always shocked to learn that you generally can't sue under the Constitution. You need a cause of action. That's why you're suing for a constitutional violation or local government, state or local issue. Now, there is one instance where there are claims directly under the Constitution. And that's, you know, the so-called Bivens suit. It takes its name from the 1971 Supreme Court case, Bivens versus six unnamed federal agents. There was an instance where federal agents broke into somebody's house, conducted a tremendously abusive search in violation of the Fourth Amendment. There's a desire to submit money anyway. Now, these were local police officers in the 1983 suit. But 1983 doesn't apply as the federal officers of the federal government. Possibility of suing the federal offices of the state tort law, it seems anomalous, but the only recovery against federal officers is a tort law. The state court held in Bivens that the cause of action for money damages could be directly inferred under constitutional provisions. So, Bivens could infer a Fourth Amendment claim for money. And likewise, for a cause of the action for money damages to the First Amendment, to the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause, the Eighth Amendment Law Mutual Consent Clause, and so on. This isn't so radical. Since the days of John Marshall on the Supreme Court, there's always been an inference of cause of action for injunctive relief directly in the Bill of Rights, the court's extension to money damages. I think Justice Harlan, in his concurring opinion in Bivens, explained this the best. He said, there are people in Bivens' shoes. It's money damages or nothing. There should be some remedy available. Subsequent to Bivens, like subsequent to Maine versus Thibodeau, the Supreme Court began eroding. And Everless is now left with Bivens. Let me tell you of some of the ways the Supreme Court is eroding it. And then I'll tell you of a cert petition that I filed on a Bivens issue on Tuesday of this week. Court has said that there won't be Bivens suits available if there are, quote, special factors counseling litigation. That really is the language the Supreme Court uses. What does that mean? Well, first the Supreme Court said those in the military cannot sue superior officers for injuries incurred in the military. And at first you might nod and say, well, the military is special. He involves a man who was serving in the military, and he was told he was going to participate in experiments regarding new protective gear. Unknown to him, he was given LSD. He said he suffered lifelong adverse consequences. This is human experimentation by every protocol of international. Exactly what the United States condemned to get nervous. Unconsent to human experiment. He sued those in the military to subject him to the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision said that Stanley could not recover. There are special factors counseling hesitation that mean there should be no civil suits for money damages available to those in the military. Second, the Supreme Court said there's a special factor of counseling hesitation that precludes there being a Bivens suit where there's another federal statute that provides a remedy. So you can't sue under the Constitution. There's another federal statute that provides a remedy. Now, again, at first blush, this might not seem so bad. The problem is there's another statute that provides a remedy. Why do you need it? Yet when you look at the cases you're on, the Supreme Court precludes it. Even though the statute didn't provide the remedy the person was seeking. But if you hear an adequate remedy, one of the cases, Bush versus Lucas, involved a name of somebody who worked for the federal government who said he was violated in violation of his First Amendment rights. He wanted money damages. a classic Bivens situation. He sued federal officers for money damages for violating his First Amendment rights.
Supreme Court said, well, Congress passed the civil service reform. Congress created civil service remedies
for those situations like abortion.
No business. But the civil service remedies don't give
money damages. They provide reinstatement, and they'll provide gap answers.
But they don't provide the ability to get money damages.
No money damage remedy that will be so.
That's a case called Schweiger versus Chalitza. The Reagan administration in its early years adopted the program of literally taking everyone who was receiving Social Security disability and taking them off the roll until they could come back and show they were entitled to Social Security disability.
So often the very nature of the disabilities meant that people couldn't do that. They'll do that very expeditiously.
With mental disabilities, I don't understand
people with certain physical disabilities might not be able to get to the Social Security office.
Every United States Court of Appeals that ruled on said that the Reagan administration acted illegally in throwing these people off the rolls.
In fact, when the circuits began to rule against the Reagan administration, it took the position it didn't have to comply with what the circuits did, except in particular cases. They developed a doctrine called executive non-acquiescence, saying we don't have to follow anything but the order in this particular case. So basically,
almost every circuit in the country ruled against the Reagan administration. Well, some individuals who illegally thrown off the Social Security disability rules sued for money damages. They said, we lost our houses because we couldn't make a mortgage payment because our Social Security disability was illegally taken away from us.
They identified other injuries.
The Supreme Court ruled against them and said they couldn't sue on their business, even though their constitutional rights were violated. They're deprived of property without due process of law.
Justice O'Connor writing to the court said, well, the Social Security Act provides them a remedy.
Doesn't matter. Reinstatement
can make that benefit, but wouldn't give them any money damages. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court said, because it's a statute that provided a remedy, no difference. Third, the Supreme Court
is going to make that difference by saying that even if the other exceptions aren't met,
if on balance it's undesirable to have a Bivens suit, it will be precluded.
This was the holding of the case in June of 2007, Wilkie v. Robinson. It involved a situation where officials of the Bureau of Land Management coerced the man in Wyoming to get an easement on his property.
And he sued them for money damages. And this wasn't suing people in the vote.
There was no statute that provided any remedy at all.
Nonetheless, Justice Souter, writing for the court, said, well, on balance, it would be better not to allow Bivens in these circumstances.
Justice Souter said, there will be a lot of lawsuits against people in the Bureau of Land Management, and that could really interfere with the effective functioning of the department. Thus, no Bivens.
I mentioned before the limit on Bivens. The Supreme Court has said that entities cannot be sued under Bivens. Only individuals can be sued under Bivens.
So in the case of FDIC versus Myers, the Supreme Court said,
the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation couldn't be sued under Bivens. Only individuals.
In the case called Correction Department versus Malesko,
the Supreme Court said that a
private prison, operator of contract, Federal Bureau of Prisons, could not be sued under Bivens.
The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit has even said that
private prison guards can't be sued under Bivens. I guess this might all seem technical, but even from the perspective of an individual who's been horribly beaten by a private prison guard, what remedy is now? Maybe there's a state court law remedy, but in some states there's complete immunity from prison guards for any liability under state court law. That would be the only of being able to sue under Bivens. And Justice Harlan's words, it's truly a bit of super money damages where it's nothing. And all of these instances with this exception, it's nothing.
Now I'll tell you about a cert petition that I filed on Tuesday of this week.
Representing Dalia Plain Wilson and Joseph Wilson, who sued against Dick Cheney, Carl Rove,
Louis Libby, and Richard Parker.
And several constitutional violations.
Valid claim boasted a just proportion alleging the suffered as a result of concerted effort to reveal valid claim status as a secret operative to punish her husband, Joseph Wilson, for exposing falsehoods of President Bush's State of the Union address. So this First Amendment claim for among damages, Joseph Wilson says this is retaliation for my speech. This claim for constitutional invasion of privacy. Tried information was revealed about that. It's the safety and danger. The claim that Dallin was punished properly is taken by depriving her of her career. This is the United States District Court of the District of Columbia, by Judge Bates, ordered the case be dismissed on two grounds. First, he said, there's another statute, which is a special statute of constant hesitation. What's the statute? The Privacy Act. There was a problem with the Privacy Act. First, the Privacy Act only protects those who are in the government. It has no application to Joe Wilson at all. And even more important, the United States Supreme Court has held, and the D.C. Circuit has even held, that the Privacy Act doesn't apply to the offices of the President and the Vice President. So notice what the District Court said. The District Court says that a statute that doesn't apply is a special factor counseling hesitation. And the second, the District Court said that the lawsuit by Valerie Flynn Wilson and Joe Wilson might lead to the disclosure of confidential classified information. And that that, under Wilkie versus Robbins, on balance, not a reason to have it. Argued the case May of last year in the D.C. Circuit. And the panel of the case was Chief Judge Santel, Judge Henderson, and Rutgers was the third judge on the panel. When I saw who the panel was, a good friend of mine said, why don't you let your 10-year-old daughter argue the case? She has as much chance of being different from you. Maybe they were mean, but she could get away with being a shit. I put out the out-disciplinary. One of my key arguments was that neither of these claims by Joe Wilson was the best. They made these arguments because, after all, the Privacy Act doesn't apply to him, and his First Amendment claim has nothing to do with classified information. Because everyone knows, public rules will be trial, that these individuals engaged in concerted effort to reveal valid claims identity as a secret actor. The government's attorney admitted in the district court hearing that she's a secret actor. So how do these arguments apply at all? I was thrilled when one of the judges of the panel even said to the attorney for the government's argument, how do your two arguments for Nagini Bivens apply to Joe Wilson? It was really no answer. I lost 2-1. The D.C. Circuit exactly the two arguments in the D.C. The existence of the Privacy Act is a special factor of constant hesitation, even though it doesn't apply at all to the office of the president, vice president. And second, this case might lead to the disclosure of classified information. Therefore, the case has to be dismissed on balance under what people stop. We'll see what the Supreme Court does. The opposition is due on March 20th, and the Supreme Court takes it. But can you put together what's done with regard to 1983, the Democratic Division? The Supreme Court has made it so much more difficult for people to be able to successfully sue for
constitutional violations.
Fourth and final observation, and I'm glad to take your question. And then to go to the question, what's the November presidential election likely to mean for the future of the Supreme Court? My conclusion is, likely to mean that the Supreme Court will stay above now ideologically.
I don't foresee the Supreme Court's going to become more conservative
or more liberal. Look for some future. What do I say? Think about what the vacancies are likely to come on the Supreme Court between January 20, 2009 and January 20, 2013, the next presidential inauguration. John Paul Stevens turns 89 years old on April 21st of this year. Raoul counts in good health, as vibrant as ever. It doesn't seem that likely he'll still be on the Supreme Court at age 93. A few weeks ago, he was diagnosed with cancer. The cancer was caught early in all news reports. On the other hand, cancer, particularly deadly form of cancer. Also, because she's frail in appearance, there's always rumors that she might step down.
There's widely circulated speculation that David Souter wants to retire to a home in before Justice Ginsburg's illness was diagnosed. Many were speculating that Justice Souter will announce his resignation at the beginning of his term. Now think of the other side of the ideological line. Chief Justice John Roberts, 55 years old, 9 months. If he remains Chief Justice until he's 88, of the age of John Bolton, he will be Chief Justice in 2043. Most of your careers and all of mine.
States have sovereign immunity
So they can't be sued in state courts or federal agencies, even when the 11th Amendment doesn't apply. The
Supreme Court has said that the 11th Amendment is just a piece of the much larger picture of sovereign immunity. The Supreme Court has said that Congress can override the 11th Amendment immunity, sovereign immunity generally, when it's acting properly pursuant to Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. You study the law in this area, you know Fitzpatrick versus Bitzer in 1976, and by then Justice Rehnquist, and he said the 14th Amendment came after the 11th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was meant to limit state sovereignty. So Congress acts under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment that it can override the 11th Amendment by suit. But then came the City of Burning versus Flores that narrowed the scope of Congress' power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court said, Congress under Section 5 can't expand the scope of rights to create new rights. It can only act to remedy or prevent violation of rights the courts recognize. That has to be proportionate and congruent during proven constitutional violations. And there's a quite confusing line of cases as to, well, when all laws within the scope of Congress's Section 5 power so that they can override the 11th Amendment. And I'm not going to go through them all right now, but you know, there are cases like Florida Prepay, there are cases on Kimmel, Garrett, Tennessee versus Lane, or on the data that the Department of Resources versus Gibbs, and the like. There, all of this, that is, I'll make it back to the point of case. There's a very important case pending right now about the scope of Congress's Section 5 powers. And I think the most important case about federalism during the John Roberts era, one of the most important cases about race, and certainly the most important case about Congress's Section 5 powers, is Northwest Austin Municipal District versus McKinsey. It involves whether Congress had the authority to extend Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act for 25 years. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 says that when there's jurisdictions that have a history of race discrimination in voting, they have to get pre-approval, pre-clearance, any change in election practices in the United States Attorney General. Just a couple of years ago, Congress, we extended this for another 25 years, was enforced on it in law. A small utility district in Texas argued to the Supreme Court that they should hear the case because the election of an African-American president shows that race discrimination in voting is no longer the problem it was. We no longer need the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and that it doesn't fit with the scope of Congress's Section 5 power. To put it another way, they're saying it's not proportionate and congruent for an improvement in constitutional violations. I think this will be the first time that the Roberts Court is considered. What's the scope of Congress's power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment? It's doing so in such an incredibly important area, but what it says there will then determine what can Congress do under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. And then that goes to when can Congress override the 11th Amendment. There's also arguments with this under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment.
I couldn't resist piggybacking on Todd's question. So sovereign immunity is the one area where it would be difficult for a heavily Democratic Congress, a Democratic president, to scale back some of these decisions. How significant should we take the Katz decision, right? And the suggestion that the bankruptcy clause is actually a weird exception to the limit on Congress's power under Article 1?
Sure. The case is Central Virginia Community College versus Katz in January 2006. And the date was very important. And the Supreme Court, 5-4, said that sovereign immunity doesn't apply in the bankruptcy. How much is the relevant? Imagine you went to a state college and you have some student loans. Whatever unforeseen reason, you have to defer bankruptcy. You want to have your student loans to the state college excused in bankruptcy. The bankruptcy code says you can do so if you can show substantial hardship. Well, the state's going to come and say, we can't be brought into the bankruptcy proceeding. We have sovereign immunity. The Supreme Court, 5-4, ruled that sovereign immunity doesn't apply in the bankruptcy. Now, hard to understand exactly why not. The Supreme Court wrote a few cases that sovereign immunity applies for patent infringement suits. Why doesn't it then apply equally much in the bankruptcy? 5-4, the Supreme Court did that.
What's important about this case, as you know, is a 5-4 with the majority being Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, Breyer, and O'Connor. The case came down 10 days before Justice O'Connor's replaced by Justice Alito. I have nothing to back up this surmise, but my guess is the court rushed the case out so it wouldn't have to be re-argued after Justice O'Connor left the court. And it hadn't been re-argued, I have no doubt it would come down 5-4 the other way. The question is, will the Supreme Court now reconsider the issue and reverse 5-4? And I don't know. I don't really care enough about sovereign immunity and bankruptcy context to overrule a recent precedent. That's what I think. Please.
It was especially worrisome for me to hear you discuss the procedural hurdle of not being able to bring a Bivens claim against contractors when Immigration and Customs Enforcement increasingly contracts to private detention centers. So aside from this example, do you see other examples in our society that coupled with this Roberts era of pushing back civil rights litigation makes our civil rights even more vulnerable?
I talk about only a small slice of cases with regard to civil rights litigation, how stores being closed. I was particularly being bitter, so that's what I focused on. But a moment ago, I alluded to attorney's fees. There was a Supreme Court decision earlier this decade called Buckhan, but in West Virginia, Department of Human Resources. What Buckhan says, my friend, why it's so destructive, is if somebody sues under Section 1983, and cause the government to change the policy, they can't recover attorney's fees. Now, if they win in court, or win with the settlement, they would get attorney's fees. But now that they caused the government to change its policy, this was a lawsuit that was brought against the agency of West Virginia through discrimination. And after 2 years of contentious litigation, the West Virginia decided to just change its policy, do everything that the plaintiffs would want. We were the catalyst for this change. We brought it about. We should get attorney's fees. Every circuit but one had said that if somebody brings a 1983 suit as a catalyst for change, they get attorney's fees. The only circuit that didn't recognize a catalyst theory was the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. And the Fourth Circuit ruled against it. The Supreme Court 5-4 affirmed the Fourth Circuit and eliminated the catalyst theory. Now, we need to recognize this, that many public interest groups depend tremendously on attorney's fees from their successful litigation in order to finance their operation. Now, any local government can stop paying attorney's fees just by changing its policy before they're about to lose in court. I'm co-counsel right now in a lawsuit, some unfortunate media attention this week, against the city of Laguna Beach, California, for an ordinance that makes it a crime to be homeless. the ordinance makes it a crime to sleep in public. Well, Laguna Beach doesn't have any ongoing shelters. There's no permanent shelters that operate. There's cold weather shelters that can operate maximum 40 nights a year. And it has no facilities that are equipped for physically disabled or mentally disabled. And so a lawsuit's been brought saying that this violates the Constitution. It can be homeless for a And I think this is a very strong argument. Laguna Beach is about to change its policy, about to repeal the ordinance. If it repeals the ordinance, it's not violated by any offense. Now, there's no doubt that this lawsuit was the catalyst for the change. But Buckhannon means no attorney's fees. Now, I was going to check that out. But at least there's no Southern California that's involved. This is one of many examples. Just a year ago, the Supreme Court ruled if somebody successfully sues for a preliminary injunction, but they don't want a permanent injunction, no attorney's fees. Well, imagine you get a preliminary injunction, say against Laguna Beach, and it lasts for 10 years. For 10 years, they can't enforce it. And then after 10 years, there's finally a trial, and Laguna Beach wins on the merits. Plaintiffs get no attorney's fees. They succeeded for 10 years in exactly what they wanted to do. Now, these are things that Congress can fix by statute. And hopefully there will be a Civil Rights Restoration Act in 2009 that does this. But even these answer your questions are just examples. I can give you a lot more examples of places where the court in this decade has put that and the abilities of our time to go for it.
Let me mention one more illustration for you.
Particularly for those of you interested in the environmental law area,
racial justice area.
Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act says that the recipients of federal money cannot discriminate based on race. The Supreme Court has said the standards under Title VI are the same as the standards of equal protection. So just as equal protection requires that the discriminatory intent, so does Title VI require discrimination. But long ago, a regulation was passed, probably in Title VI, that says that recipients of federal funds cannot engage in practices that have a racially discriminatory impact. Imagine the city decides to locate a garbage dump, or every garbage dump, in minority communities. I might be able to prove there's discriminatory intent. That's awfully hard to show. But you can at least show a discriminatory impact. Or bus routes in the city of Los Angeles. It's amazing how bus routes in the city of Los Angeles tremendously favor more affluent whites compared to the poor Latinos and Asians in America. Show discriminatory intent. We can sure show discriminatory intent. So how would such claims be brought? Under the Title VI regulations. You would sue and say, these are recipients of federal funds in the age of practice. This is discriminatory intent. In Alexander versus Sandoval in 2001, the Supreme Court ruled that there's no cause of action for money damages under the Title VI regulations. You can't sue under the Title VI regulations at all. So the racial justice case I mentioned, the bus from case, can't be brought. Again, Congress by statute, it's not for the removal of vehicle legislative case. So again, these are just examples. Please.
I was wondering, we were just recently talking in our constitutional class about how the term, the length terms are getting longer on the Supreme Court. And you were talking about the ages of some of the justices. I was wondering what effect do you think that has, that the term, the life terms are getting longer, and if you think that there would ever maybe be an imposition of term limits on the justices.
The statistics are less clear than we're seeing. Think back to John Marshall, how long he was on the Supreme Court, how long he was on the Supreme Court.
So even though lifespans are increasing, the being on the Supreme Court really is a good predictor of a long life.
My former colleague, Paul Parent,
wrote a book about it that urged 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices.
As I look at it, I have to confess, I shrugged and say, well, I wouldn't have wanted 18-year term for Justice Brennan or for Justice Stevens.
I would really like to see an 18-year term for Chief Justice Roberts.
How does all of that play out? I personally think it would take a constitutional amendment to think about it. Because I read the language of Article 3, Amendment, Justice Supreme Court, the lower average positions for a lot of similar behavior. And I can't imagine that 2/3 of the 12,000 counties and 2/4 of the state
as a constitutional amendment in this regard, it's just not perceived as a significant amount of problem.
I don't have any feelings one way or the other about it. I'd like term limits to be before the discord. I wouldn't like it in other instances. I don't think an 18-year term or 20-year term would be a bad thing. Not a bad thing for most federal judges. But I don't see it passing so soon.
Kind of backing off of that, obviously, like, we know Bush appointed, you know, two younger justices with the intent of having them on the court for a long time. Do you think Obama will try to play out the same strategy, so maybe whoever will again be on the court for 30 or 40 years? And who do you foresee him appointing?
I'd like him to appoint my 10-year-old daughter. I'm 55. I would no longer be seeing justices at that age being put on the Supreme Court. Not that some of these people isn't a certain career, but I think John Roberts, age 50,
is much more the model of what we're looking to
than we do start to get to what your question is about. Nick contradictions is always reminding the answer to your question when my grandmother was alive. She'd see a pregnant woman, she always guessed the gender of her children. But she got it right. She never let you get it. But she got it wrong, she never let you. In the spirit of my grandmother, my prediction is that the first person who doesn't come out will be a woman. And I think he's likely to pick the Latina. And the two most common names that are advanced are Sonia Sotomayor from the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and Kim Ward from the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. But I have no inside information of any of my but that would be my guess for the first picks of the Latina. And he gets three picks, then I get Latina. If I had any chance of advising besides Young, I would advise him that somebody else with substantial experience to get a trial.
Mm-hmm.
It's another talk, they don't let you get that. But I think the order of the Supreme Court has done in terms of confusion over what's the standard for the trial? What's the standard for a motion to dismiss? How do you expect a jury to put it in? I don't believe the Supreme Court had justices who spent substantial experience as trial lawyer who would have this. So I certainly think the court is more than one load on the Supreme Court. You get in front of the Latinas and Asians and Latinas.
One other interesting thing about that, all nine current justices were at least for some time the Federal Court of Appeals judge for Puerto Rican justice. The Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education on the court. None of the nine justices had ever been a Federal Court of Appeals. Please.
Turning back to
business,
you mentioned Wilkie v. Robbins.
Yes.
And that's, of course, the most recent pronouncement. It certainly figured very largely in the Wilson v. Libby case. Can you see anything positive with respect to the future of Bivens litigation in Libby? Specifically, perhaps the fact that the court regarded the case as a close call in the first stage of the analysis, notwithstanding that there was a virtual complete remedy available for all of the claims involved, or perhaps also with respect to the fact that in that case, different from almost all others, the trial court did permit what could be regarded as jurisdictional discovery.
I use the D.C. Circuit briefs and cert petition, the language, especially the D.C. Circuit, when Wilkie was about to be appointed, that they were willing to get past whether there's a statute to include it
and get to the unbalanced. So I think for litigants, there is that beneficial
language Wilkie for spouse. I'm in great trouble because I see Wilkie as creating a whole new obstacle to differences. Even if there is no statute about the action, if on balance it's undesirable that there's include the action. And that's what Judge Bates in the district court sees that in the valid litigation. And that's what Judge Santel's opinion in the D.C. Circuit sees that. So that's trouble. But yes, I think there are things in Wilkie versus Robbins that Bivens point is incredible on units. I think you're absolutely right. But overall, you got Justice Scalia saying,
Bivens was a mistake. Let's not extend it any further.
And I think when you put Wilkie together with the Action Department versus Molesto and other cases, I think it's important that basically Bivens was a mistake. Let's not extend it. And then if you're going to say, but let's cut it down. And that's what I see with the right words. And I think you should listen to it. Please.
Yes. So now with the new president and the Democratic majority, and especially this administration's emphasis on restoring civil rights and liberties, I guess, as they see them having been undone under the Bush administration, what do you think the prospects actually are for the Congress possibly enacting legislation to prevent some of these limitations that you're speaking of on the ability to bring suits under 1983?
I think there's an excellent chance for a Civil Rights Restoration Act 2009 and 2010. I think it is extremely important that this be a high priority and action be taken now, that we not anticipate those who want this, that all will be 4 or 8 years to do it. So, and this goes to the appointment of lower court judges too. It's important to remember the lesson of the Clinton presidency. Clinton took office in 1993, and civil rights community, that was a lot of time. He's going to be there for 8 years. Democrats lost Congress in 1994. Starting in 1995, there was a Republican majority vote in the House and the Senate. There were judicial vacancies when Clinton took office He didn't nominate anybody his first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then he's very limited if he could pick the federal judiciary after that, but he didn't get it through the Republican Senate. So the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights here in D.C. is taking the lead in drafting the Civil Rights Restoration Bill. I think one thing that's going to be necessary is that the public interest community has to get together and agree on what's there. And some people are going to have to give up something that we're going to make consensus on. That's hard to do. I've often thought, I say this a little, the left is going to sit in a circle and shooting at themselves. This is a place where it's going to happen. They're really going to be
I think I read in the New York Times that the current court has more teaching time than actual court time than any other court out there. Is that true? And what do you think is the effect on the say the how it decides, how it makes its decisions?
I don't think the Supreme Court justices have nearly enough cases on their backs. Statistically, I chopped up how the number of cases has gone down. If you compare the number of opinions per justice compared to any other court, you say, well, what they're dealing with these momentous issues. Well, I think usually about a third of the docket is dealt with through unanimous decisions and short opinions. So, you know, when you see years where the justices write 10, 11, 12 opinions coming, concurring the same thing for the entire term, you say, gosh, they really could be working harder. And I think that makes feeling. I'm not sure I want them deciding more 1983 indifference cases in light of what they're doing. On the other hand, there are a lot of splits among the circuits and the states that need being resolved. I don't know any way to deal with this other than the justices being shamed and taking more cases. I think this year there will be an increase in the docket. This term will be over 80 cases, nowhere near the 160 cases from a decade ago. In October term of 1988, just 20 years ago, the court decided 162 cases. We're in October term of 2008, and we've got 80 cases.
I remember when Chief Justice John Roberts was fighting for him, he spoke a lot about wanting to get more unanimous decisions, less 5-4 decisions. We talked about a lot of the decisions Kennedy was right in the middle on, 5-4 ones, but do you think overall the trend is still towards more divided decisions like that, or have you seen more unanimous decisions?
Year before last, I mentioned there were 67 cases and 24 were 5-4. Last year, there were 68 cases and 14, 68 was 2-0, and 24 were 5-4, last year 67, and 14 were 5-4, I don't think that that's a kind of there fewer cases defined by ideology. I think there's much that the Chief Justice can do to stop there being 5-3 decisions. You're dealing with 9 highly independent individuals who are going to vote their conscience. And the meaning of the Second Amendment for issues of the court for this term, I think there are going to inevitably be 5-4 splits among the court. And if there are 11 justices, it would be 6-5. If there are 7, it would be 4-3. I think the nature of the court is ideologically divided. Now, I think had John McCain won as president, we would have many fewer 5-4 cases than that. Because again, McCain replaced Stevens, Henry Ginsburg, Henry Souter, Justice White, Roberts, and Alito, Scalia, and Thomas. Then you could have had many fewer 5-4 cases. And depending on the politics, you may think that would have been a good or a bad thing. But I don't think there's anything that should justice and to do to be some of the possible cases on matters that are ideologically defined and ideologically split. Okay, thank you so much.